Good morning, Drew.
Good morning.
Ah, wonderful to hear you. So welcome to Apes Update. The radio station is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. And I'm on the phone now with Drew Nickel, who has contributed an enormous amount of his time and energy to the cause of something near and dear to the listeners of Apes Update's hearts, which is the plight of the mountain gorilla. And Drew, you have a bachelor's degree in zoology.
I do.
And you have been an animal lover, but tell us how this all came about.
Well, I basically like to think of this as something that has been sort of stewing and brewing in me for my first 40 years of life. I've been an animal lover my entire life. I have been very, very concerned about the conservation aspects of great apes in particular. They've been very near and dear to my heart, especially mountain gorillas. I think a lot of it just kind of had to do with, as a kid, I loved King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little extra special thing there as a kid. I just sort of drifted and meandered through life. I do have a zoology degree, but the fact that it took me 9 years to get my bachelor's degree didn't exactly help as far as my career pursuits as a primatologist. So one thing led to another, and I basically sort of came back to what had always been inside of me when I was 40 years old, and I was sitting in a movie theater watching Peter Jackson's remake of King Kong in December of 2005, as odd as that might sound. So once I decided that I really, really wanted to do something, I guess from there, for me, it was a matter of, what exactly do I do? I mean, I think a lot of people, they've always loved primates, and they go see Jane Goodall speak, and that inspires them, or they take a trip someplace, and they see them in the wild, and that inspires them. I had sort of my odd moment in a movie theater. But once I really decided to do something, it was sort of a matter of, what exactly am I going to do? And that's essentially what I've been trying to figure out over the last year, because the biggest transition was going from being somebody that always thought about something, somebody that cared about something, boy, I really would like to do something to help, and then actually becoming that person that starts to no longer become a person of words and a person of action, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. And I think I had a similar transformation, although on a smaller scale, a number of years ago when I first read Next of Kin, What Chimpanzees Have Taught Me About Being Human by Roger Fouts,
mm-hmm.
I felt this overwhelming need to do something. So having this radio show, I thought, all right, well, maybe I could at least draw public attention to the plight of the gorillas, the chimpanzees and orangutans, the primates, and also look at some of the unique forms of their intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So what you did, correct me if I'm wrong,
uh-huh.
is you did a solo trek last month?
I did.
To raise funds for these gorillas. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the only thing I knew for sure that I wanted to do when I got started and, so to speak, became a man of action, was I knew I wanted to do a fundraising walk. It was the one thing that I was tangible. I'd seen people do it. Okay, that's the one thing I know I can do. So I just decided that was going to be, sort of a personal commitment and a great way to raise money and awareness. So I couldn't decide exactly, where to go, how to do it. And then just little by little, I just kind of put pieces and bits together. It seemed like going from a zoo to a zoo made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly starting from here in the Seattle area from Woodland Park Zoo, which has a very, very strong gorilla conservation program and is a home base. So that was a natural fit. And, I thought anything from walking, 50 miles to maybe walk it across the country. And I just had to sort of set my sights on a realistic goal the first time, not knowing. And so Portland was perfect. It was roughly 200 miles. I kind of kept the focus in the Northwest for now. And so basically that became the plan of attack. So the journey itself was I'd have to call it the greatest personal experience of my life. It's the first time I've ever really gotten truly outside of myself, which happened about halfway through the trip when I spent the first few days just stuck in my own mind complaining about blisters and sore feet and numb toes and shin splints. And then at just a certain point, I kind of got past that. And this sounds sort of, I guess I'll use the word hokey, but this is really the thing that kept me motivated and walking the whole time. And this part of it came in literally the morning that I left Woodland Park Zoo. And that was the inspirational story of somebody that did something that I personally think was far greater than what I did. I mean, I tell people that all the time, like, don't look up to me. Look up to what I'm representing. But here's the real hero. So there's a guy named Andre Boma, who is a ranger, an African ranger. I believe he's Congolese, and he's been working with mountain gorillas as a tracker and a guide for years and years and years. And so I'm sure, as many of your listeners are aware, there was quite a few sort of random killings last year in the Congo that weren't really related to the typical reasons that gorillas are killed, which is poaching or bushmeat. These were actually sort of political statements that had to do with the charcoal trade in the Congo. Anyway, Andre Boma had worked with the Rigendo group for years. He knew them. They were like his family. This was a very large habituated group of gorillas that tourists used to go see before things really got too unruly in the Congo. He heard the gunfire during one of these killings in the jungle. He ran over to the spot where he had heard the gunfire. There was a few dead gorillas there. I'm sure it was just, I can't even imagine what it would have been like. Oh. But there was a 2.5-month-old infant, female, that was clinging to her dead mom. And he picked her up and he carried her through, I can't even imagine. I mean, I was walking along these, you know, single lane highways, and, you know, every once in a while I'd have to jump into a ditch. Yeah. Or, you know, a truck would come by and the wind would sort of, you know, and I had shin splints and stuff. But it was nothing compared to what this guy did, you know, 3 a.m, walking through the jungle, rebels, et cetera. And he carried this infant for miles and miles and miles to a sanctuary in Goma and personally saved it. So
true.
That was the thing that kept me really going the whole time.
What makes a man like that pick up a 2.5-month-old, you know, abandoned gorilla infant and carry it to safety? What do you think it is?
Love.
Just plain and simple?
I think plain and simple, love. Yeah, when I saw his picture the very first time, it moved me kind of like that big, lovable, 30-foot-tall computer-generated gorilla that Peter Jackson created. It just absolutely moved me. It's a picture of him shortly after he got to the sanctuary. And you can see the look on his face. He's holding this infant. You see this look of exhaustion. You see this look of concern. And you see this look of a man who is emotionally so drained because of what he just experienced in basically seeing some of his best friends killed. So, you know, a lot of things, but I guess, Benny, really, it's love.
Did the infant survive?
Yeah, she did. She ended up contracting pneumonia, and you know, this is sort of the ironic thing, and this is something I definitely want to talk about, because I didn't really understand what one of the major and really the major issue was with mountain gorillas till I got heavily involved. But she ended up contracting pneumonia. She was in contact with quite a few people shortly after this took place when she got to the sanctuary. The UN got involved. I think there was a couple doctors that came in, veterinarians, and some of the folks from the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, but she ended up contracting pneumonia, and he stayed with her 24/7. He basically, you know, nursed her with milk. He would steam these eucalyptus leaves, and he made a sort of a homemade respirator under a blanket with her. I mean, he stayed with her and nursed her back to health, because that was sort of the second phase of the trauma, so to speak, was her contracting a pretty serious disease from contact with people.
Utter devotion. How does the fundraising part work? It, you know, if anyone's listening and thinking, you know what, I want to get on the stick too, I want to get off my couch and do something proactive. Mm-hmm. How did you publicize your walk and then people sponsored you? Tell us how you raised money and how much you were able to raise.
So far I'm at about 35,000. And I didn't really have a goal when I started. Looking back on this, if I was to do it again, I would probably set a specific goal and sort of attack it, maybe in a little bit more of an organized fashion. But, you know, I've really been, I think of myself as very laser focused on my mission, but I've been flying by the seat of my pants for the last year, just figuring things out as I go, because I've never done anything like this before. I've just been wrapped up in a career for the last 10 years, you know. And my plan was really twofold. One was I was going to contact all of my friends and all of my family, all of my clients, everybody that I know, and I would just sort of filter out through my, you know, world. So so to speak, and just people would, you know, ask for you know, pledges, and hey, if you know anybody that would support this. So I'd say probably half of the money came through that avenue.
Mm-hmm.
The other half is there are a few folks that I know that have some media contacts, and I think the key word here is persistence. But being persistent without being annoying. So I would get the name of, you know, a friend of mine that has this great story about a bald eagle that he saved. There was a story in the paper. He gave me the name of someone at the Seattle Times. And so I just consistently would email her, call her, not, you know, three times a day, but let's just say every 3 or 4 days, you know, hey, don't mean to bug you. And so finally she just, you know, after the 37th email, she was too busy, but she did at least pass it on to an editor. Another reporter got a hold of it. He contacted me, put a story on the front page of the local section of the Seattle Times. I believe that was in April. And then that really sort of got the public aware of what I was doing. And so quite a few people came out of the woodwork, so to speak, and through that, because once the newspaper article came out, I kind of went from a guy that was trying to get his face out there to all of a sudden I was kind of getting contacted by various folks, you know, such as yourself, your perfect example, and I got some local television coverage, and so I you know, that part's been awesome, because I've had a tremendous amount of local support, and I have also found there's quite a nice little network of people in the Northwest and in the greater Seattle Puget Sound area that are, you know, very concerned. They're philanthropic, they've been involved, they've spent time there. You know, I've had some great contacts, especially over the last 30 days. So it's basically how I did it. I mean, you kind of have to go part execution, and you kind of have to go part, let's try this and see what happens.
You make it up as you go along. You know, Scott Fitzgerald said, there are no second acts in American lives, and we're all out here busy disproving that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you are a fantastic example of someone who is creating a second and probably a third and fourth act. So you work in business?
I do.
Okay, and so how did you get the time off to do this walk, and
well,
what is the company?
Well, I'm in the mortgage business, so I've had a lot of time off in the last year. I created the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I decided to do this and this thing really started coming together, and I knew that I had to carve out the time. You know, I knew my wife was going to have to be sort of supportive and patient of this because, you know, the demands were pretty large time-wise. I mean, I spent a tremendous amount of my spare time walking. In March and April and May, trying to prepare to walk, you know, 23 miles a day, 10 days in a row. The contacts, the putting up the website, the making a CD, DVD, that took a tremendous amount of time. And then really starting to partner up with a specific group that I just sort of, you know, I mean, the whole way I came across the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project is just sort of an amazing story in and unto itself. But I carved the time out. I mean, I really did. I mean, I've been somewhat fortunate in that I'm in a business that is, I'm relatively autonomous. I don't punch a clock. I've got an assistant that, can handle a lot of the details, so to speak. And she's very, very supportive of what I'm doing on the gorilla side. And I guess that's kind of how. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Absolutely.
But.
You know, we have a lot of listeners who are seated at their computer monitors while they're listening to the radio. And I want to urge them right now to go to the website, gorillasinourmidst.org.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Gorillasinourmidst, MIDST.org. You will see some amazing photographs. I think you'll also see Andre Beaumont and the infant chimp there.
No, there aren't any pictures of Andre and Dikazi, but on the homepage of the website, there's a, you can see where you can click onto my blog. I just did a blog report with the guy that did my website.
Okay,
by the
wait
way,
a minute. That's
an amazing
what it was.
Job.
Wait,
I
that's
mean,
what it was.
He's a friend.
Yeah.
I used to work with him, and I knew he did websites, and he definitely was supportive of my Mountain Gorilla cause. And so I had this whole idea, and I gave him some, you know, I want to do this and this and this. Here's some pictures. And he put that website up, which was mm-hmm. almost as complete as, you know, as your listeners are seeing it right now. I mean, it's a beautiful website.
Absolutely beautiful.
There's a blog on there, and you can click on it. And it's, so it basically tells the story of my walk. It's pretty silly and funny and, you know, wacky little things along the way. But then at the very end of it is the powerful message. And there's a very large picture of Andre and Endikazi right there, which tells the story.
You're planning a trip in the fall to Rwanda?
I am. Yeah, I'm going to be. I'll be going to be going to Rwanda in October with a group, ecotourist, Terra Incognita Ecotourist. Jed Caddick is a one of the best as far as tour guides go on you know, ecotourism type trips to remote places, and his passion is the mountain gorillas. He does trips all over the world, but so I am going on that trip in October for about 10 days, 9 days. I'll be in Rwanda. So.
You know, I hope there is a groundswell occurring of interest in primate issues. You know, in the New York Times just a few days ago was a column about the fact that Spain's parliament recently passed a resolution granting legal rights to apes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very controversial thing. And it also lends itself, unfortunately, to mockery and things like that. Like, what next? Are we going to give goldfish the right to vote? You know, and it's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
But in fact, if you get at all affected by and involved with primates, you can't help but see how close we are to them and how mm-hmm. much they contribute. I think we ought to also now say, even though there is all this attention, the situation is really dire.
It's very dire.
So it perhaps is. You could lay that out a little bit for the listeners and then maybe give them a sense of what they can do.
Okay. You know, I think the direst situation is what's going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And of course, that's had a tremendous amount of media attention, which has been, I think, excellent because I think it's been accurately reported. And fortunately, I saw something recently on National Geographic that also addressed sort of the hidden but very, very, very real problem with the gorillas. So you've got roughly 700 mountain gorillas left in the entire world. There's, you know, estimates vary a little bit, but that's the general, you know, number, give or take. You have 380 mountain gorillas that are in the Virunga Mountains. Basically, all of them are in one protected park. It's two parks, but it's one landmass with the border between Rwanda and the DRC going right down the middle. And there's roughly 200 gorillas in the Congo. There's roughly 180 in Rwanda. And they don't, you know, they more or less tend to keep to themselves. There's some speculation that maybe the gorillas in the Congo, because of what's going on there, are, you know, heading over the mountains, so to speak, but no real evidence of that yet. But, you know, part of the problem is nobody's really monitoring the gorillas in the Congo right now. And then you've got 320 mountain gorillas up in Uganda in the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest. So, you know, as far as things go, I mean, there's really a dichotomy here with mountain gorillas, which is really unusual because it's all in such a very small remote area. I mean, that's it. I mean, just those two little parks, which are really separated, I think, by about 20 miles, that's it. That's the entire population in the world. You don't have fallback populations. Mm. You don't have breeding populations in captivity in zoos. There are none. That's, you know, that's it. So that's basically what, you know, primatologists, so to speak, that have dedicated to the cause, that's the group they have to work with. So, you know, things are going extremely well in Rwanda. They're going very, very well in Uganda. But in the Congo, there's a tremendous problem because of the civil war, the ongoing civil war, and the illegal charcoal trade. It's a huge problem there.
Well, how did they make things better in Rwanda?
That's good question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Rwanda has sort of risen out of the ashes. It has everything to do with the recovery from the genocide to the history of mountain gorilla conservation. I mean, Diane Fossey started in the Congo, but really because of the political turmoil when she first went over there, she ended up in Rwanda as well, and that's where she established Karasoki Research Center. So, you know, there's sort of this long-running history, and going back, you know, really basically since her death, at least with the Mount Gorilla Veterinary Project. But, you know, Paul Kagame is really appears to be one of the greatest leaders in the history of Africa, to be perfectly honest. There's certainly a controversial figure. He's, you know, what was his real role? And you know, he had a lot to do with ending the genocide. But he has really brought Rwanda back, and it's become stable. It's become safe. He has embraced gorilla tourism, which is a critical part of the whole circle of, you know, how do we maintain this? I mean, you've got this densely populated country. You've got up to 500 people per square kilometer living right up to the boundary of the park. I mean, you know, sometimes their gorillas come out of the park and they're, you know, they're in people's little plots of land and stuff. So, but, you know, it's taken a long, long time. But, Rwanda, you know, one of the reasons Rwanda is such a success story right now is because the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project has a One Health approach. So they have diversified their philosophy, so to speak, over the last few years into a let's monitor the health of everything. Let's monitor the health of the gorillas. Let's monitor the health of other wildlife. Let's monitor the health of the park rangers. Let's monitor the health of the military, the people. They work with the clinics and the villages and as well as the livestock. I mean, everything's interacting with each other. I think people, a lot of folks are under the impression that the mountain gorillas are in a very remote area, which they are. But there's a tremendous amount of interaction between the gorillas, several different groups of people, other wildlife, buffalo, livestock, and, you know, there's this connectivity that takes place. So the One Health approach is working.
A couple of questions, Drew. Clearly, humans are a danger to gorillas. Are gorillas a danger to humans?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Well, humans are a danger to gorillas.
Humans are a danger to gorillas.
Are gorillas a danger to humans?
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. No, gorillas are not a danger to humans.
Because you said that they're living very close to us.
Yeah, they are not a danger to humans. They're not a danger directly. You know, I was watching some little thing in the news where a news reporter was watching this thing about gorilla tourism, and at the end of it, the news woman said, "Ooh, scary," you know, and then her and the other guy were talking about it. You know, would you go do that? Oh, no, no, no. You know, and they were talking about this fear of, you know, what if a silverback comes and, you know, tears them apart? I mean, there really isn't, there's no threat there.
You know, I think, Drew, this is an important point to make because I think that the projection onto the gorilla of it being a savage killer is very, very wrong.
It's one of the biggest problems.
One of the biggest problems. So we have to demystify that and get some of the facts out of there. You know, for one thing, it sounds out there. It sounds like the preservation issue is twofold. One is to protect the limited amount of gorillas that are alive now.
Yes.
And then how do you foster more numbers in the population? Because that used to be, I believe, the old zoo philosophy was let's get them in captivity so that we can breed. So what's the better way to go? Because that has problems. Or is that also partly good?
Well, you know, I think the when I talked to Dr. Mike Cranfield, who's the director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, about, you know, what is the sustainability of this area that they're in? I mean, I think what if there's more, you know, a larger area in the future for the gorillas to live in? I think that is, I'm not going to say it could never happen, but I think it's unrealistic. So the critical thing is, okay, let's address where they are in the state of the park right now. So, you know, he thinks that the park could sustain probably twice as many as are actually there. So if there's roughly 380 in the Virungas, that area could probably sustain a population of, what, say, you know, 760. The thing about the parks themselves is they're almost like they've almost become sort of a wild zoo. There's this, I call it a double-edged sword, call it whatever you want, but the bottom line is the situation is as it is. Now, you know, I've even personally had differing opinions on, you know, gorilla tourism. How really good is it for them to be in proximity with us and for them to be quote-unquote tame and you know, for them to be approachable? I mean, it's not a wild place. And I definitely have had people, you know, have pretty serious, you know, discussions with me. You know, do you really think veterinary care for wild animals is a good idea? But, you know, the park itself is a very, very, very large source of revenue for the country of Rwanda. That's part of what's added to Rwanda's stability, okay? And so the millions of dollars a year of tourism keep the park functioning, keep it safe, keep everything sort of functioning as one unit. I mean, it really is amazing what's going on in Rwanda. I mean, the president has a Gorilla Appreciation Day where people travel from all over the countryside.
Oh,
and they just literally have a day of celebration for the gorillas, both personally, admiration, and what the gorillas have done for them. So, you know, if you don't have a healthy tourism industry in Rwanda, you've got the park, which is basically its golden goose, so to speak. I mean, I hate to use that word, but, you now have the park system, which doesn't have a major source of revenue. So what potentially happens with the park system? And that is very, very lush rainforest, which acts as a sponge during the rainy season. Now, if the gorillas, you know, let's just, you know, if the gorillas aren't there or the parks are closed and no one can see the gorillas anymore, I don't really know what would happen there, but it would not be good for the country. Do you follow me?
Absolutely.
So, you know, what you potentially have is, you know, worst case scenario, the gorillas, you know, there's no protection, or the gorillas, let's just say they're gone. Okay, those parks are going to be gone. And when the rainy season comes, the erosion factor with those volcanic mountains and what that does to the land below would be catastrophic, and it would completely tear down what has been built up in that country. And, you know, so therein lies the problem.
So tremendous domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
One problem leading to another problem. You know, earlier I had said, as I sometimes do on Apes Update, that these primates are our closest cousins. And, you know, mm-hmm. we know that chimpanzees share 98% of our DNA. But, you know, I want to almost amend that notion, which is that we don't need to just feel similar to these beings in order to want to save them. I just use that because it's a way of getting people to feel something, to feel some kind of connection, like
yes.
they're like us. But you know what? Even if they're not like us, they are astonishing creatures. And the diversity of species on this planet that are rapidly being, you know, brought to a small number is a terrible, terrible loss.
It is. You know, I mean, the statistics are endless. The statistics are staggering. There's one particular gentleman that I've become acquainted with the last few months who I know I will have a long-term friendship, kinship in the world of primate conservation. And you know, he's 67 years old. He was born in Malaysia, and we were talking. I think it was our very first conversation. He said, "Drew, when I was born in Malaysia 67 years ago, the population was roughly 7 million people, and the country was over 90% jungle. As I stand here mm-hmm. today talking to you, the population is now over 28 million people, and there's less than 10% jungle." So, you know, there's a country with an awful lot of one of the very few species of great apes, orangutan. So, it's scary, and sometimes you hear those things, and it's like people get hopeless. I mean, they do. They get hopeless. And, you know, I am far more positive than I am bleak. I think there is a tremendous amount of hope. I mean, I look at Rwanda as the shining example. I mean, I know deep down in my heart I would love nothing more than to see thousands and thousands of gorillas in the wild just be wild. Mm. But I understand that the world is, you know, this is where we're at today. How do we make this work? And how do we preserve what is left and hopefully even get it to rebound and recover and do it in a way that isn't propped up? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, Drew Nichols, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time. And I have more questions. And perhaps we can do a part two at some point.
I would love to.
Really?
I would like to talk a little bit more about the Mount Gorilla Veterinary Project. And, you know, I think listeners like the stories of how does this kind of thing happen. The story of kind of how I came across Mike Cranfield and how he connected is just a great little tale in and out of itself.
So what are you doing next Thursday at 11:30?
Sounds good.
Okay. Part two with Drew Nichol of GorillasInOurMidst.org. Please visit that website and consider how you can do something on this amazing cause. And I'm sure this is also said to you a lot, and it's corny, but you are an inspiration. You really are.
Thank you. To me, Andre Boma is an inspiration. So.
Well, it's a chain. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you more about King Kong. I want to talk to you about images of these animals, our relationship with animals, and anything else you'd like to do. So we'll do a little part two next week.
Excellent.
Thanks
Jenny.
So
Thank
much.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate
Take
it.
Take good care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.